This is an interview for the Mill Workers Oral History Project. The date is January 27th, 2006, and we're at the home of Madeline LeBlanc, and this is Andrea Lemieux. Could you start just by giving me your date of birth and where you were born?
I was born here in Lewiston, Maine, in Hines Alley, in fact. My date of birth is June 28, 1924. I'll be 82 years old come this June.
And so you grew up in the Lewiston area?
Yes, I did.
What was Lewiston like at that time?
From what I can remember, I mean, let's say I started going out when I was 15, 16. Mm-hmm. It was altogether different. Lisbon Street was, if you had seen the play, Lewiston, A New Home for Me, they described Lisbon Street to perfect. You know, there was Ward Brothers and Lamy Willahan, and Lamy Willahan at one time had me walk around with a pair of new high-heel shoes because they were an odd size. And it was great. And I did most of my shopping at Ward's at the time. Now it's Walmart and Kmart. Lisbon Street was quite different. People were friendly. Mm. You know, you'd walk on Lisbon Street and it seems that everyone knew everybody else. You know, they all knew one another.
And there was a lot more walking and shopping rather than...
Oh yes, there was a lot of shopping. Yeah. Oh yes. On paydays, you know, it was the streets were, the sidewalks were crowded. It was they held all those dime stores, Woolworth, Kresge, and Grant's stores, and I remember all those stores. I used to go into Grant's. We used to come in Grants by Park Street, and you could go out on Lisbon Street. And they were great stores. And then Grant moved, I think, where the Sears is today.
Now, did Grants have a lunch counter?
Kresge had.
Kresge did.
Kresge had a lunch counter. Yeah. No, Grants, Grants didn't have a lunch counter.
What sorts of things did your parents do when you were growing up for social activities? Do you remember?
Oh, yes. We'd go to my Grant's parents' house, gather around the piano, and the whole family would sing French songs, of course. And my uncles were Rancourt. I mean, the Rancourt brothers. And they sang quite a bit of English. They were in the group that you don't hear much about nowadays, Le Fayon. Yeah, they were in that. And I think I was 12 years old, and they took me along for one of their practices, and I was singing along with them. I really enjoyed singing. That's one of my favorite things. Reading, as you can see, and singing.
And so, did you have a fairly large family living in the area?
On my mother's side, yes. There were 13 in my mother's family. With my father's side of the family was more scattered, mm-hmm. You know, we didn't visit as much. I remember staying while my mother had one of my brothers. In those days, they didn't keep us around when the time came for deliver, you know. And I went to spend my aunt, Blanche was her name, Mayotte. She lived on Bates Street. And I stayed there for about 3 weeks, 3-4 weeks. And that was on my father's side. That was about it, you know. And, but on my mother's side, it was a great aunt and Mrs. Carpenter that used to live on Bartlett Street. And I used to go to the St. Dom's, the hockey games at St. Dom's, and New Donau Beauvoir and all these people. They were quite good, the hockey then, and that was at St. Dom's. That is now gone, I guess. So.
And you mentioned your grandparents. Were they from Lewiston or had they come from Canada?
They came from Canada, but located here in Lewiston, where the city dump is today. That used to be the Rancourt's farm. And then they sold to move to the city because the boys were not interested, my uncles were not interested in farming. Mm. But they had a big farm, They used to sell their milk to Hoods. Mm-hmm. I remember the canisters of milk by the side of the road, and there's a truck would pick it up. And yes, and I had a pet rooster. It followed me all. When I see that commercial with all the chickens following the people, it reminds me of my pet rooster. He used to follow me, but in a friendly way.
Yeah. And did either of your parents work in the mill?
My father. My father's the one who got me to work at the Androscoggin Mill. And I had over there my father, my Uncle Joe, my Uncle Ernest Moran. Then on my husband's side, that's where I met my husband, at the Androscoggin. His name was Willett, Emilian Willett. And his brother was secondhand, they called it, or you'd say foreman today, on the third shift. And his uncle was foreman on the first shift. And Tony Martell was the superior, and Dean Quinton was the big overall manager, you might call it. Mm. They call him the super.
Yeah. Did your father ever talk about working in the mill? And
oh yes, yes.
I
was living at home, of course, and we used to go to leave for work together and come back together, and one time. I'd go to my father, kiss him on the cheek, and we'd sit there and talk. And a woman came up to him at one time. She said, "Aren't you ashamed having an affair with a young girl like that?" And my father laughed, you know, because she had no idea I was his daughter. They thought it was an old man flirting with a young girl. That was cute. And then my husband was a weaver at the time. Well, we weren't married at the time, and I was what you call a battery hand. I used to fill up the shuttles with the bobbins and put them in the machine. And we got to talking, and one time he asked me, I had a friend there, Jeanette Routier. She's from New Hampshire. She's now married and living to a police officer living in Connecticut. And we used to go out together quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And so my husband says, what do you and your girlfriend do on Saturday nights? We'd go to the was the Acme Club on Lisbon Street. There was a dance there, there was an orchestra, and we'd go out there and dance, you know, and then come back home. And it was nice evenings, you know. Today, if you go out, two girls together, they think you're going out to pick up someone. It's changed so much, you know. It's sad because so many lives and many, to me, good times are spoiled because of people narrow-minded thinking. But
So how old were you when you started at the Androscoggin Mill?
18 years old. And I, you might say I started going out with my husband when I was maybe 20 years old. And my friend would date his brother. His brother was working there too. And I'd go out with my husband. And I married him when I was 24. We got married when I was 24. And I had my beautiful daughter, Anne, when I was 25. We were married for 8 years, and then he died. He was only 35, and he had a heart attack. My little girl was 6, and my son was 3, Andre.
Yes.
That's what I was telling Mr. Silva yesterday. I said, I didn't forget your name because I have a son named Mark.
Oh.
And I said, I won't forget the lady either because I have a son named Andre. Yours is Andrea. Yes. Yeah. So.
So did you stay in that position for about 12 years? Or you stayed at the Androscoggin Mill for 12 years, but did your position change?
Oh, yes. I became a weaver. I was a weaver for quite a while, and then I became a room girl. In those days, they'd post the jobs on the sheet of paper and post the jobs at both ends of the mill, and if you wrote your name down, you know, and then it went to the office, and that they went by seniority because the union was in, so they went by seniority and. And so, but I remember during the war, there was two young girls working, and Pat Goodboo, and her name Ida Fox, now is her name. Their boyfriends were in the army, and when they'd come in on, they were my battery hands. I was a weaver at the time, and they were my battery hands, see? And they tell me, oh, Eddie or who's coming home, and I have only 3 days to see him and all this and that. I said, well, I'll be real sick at 7:30, you go home. And I'd stop my looms and tell the boss, I have to go home, I'm sick. So the girls could go. Then those girls married the boys that they were going out with at the time. Yeah, Pat was going out. Pat Goodboo was going out with Roger Bell, and she married him. And so it was like family. We were doing for each other, you know. So.
And did you mention that union came into the mills right after you started working there, or what was the union already involved when you began work?
When I went in the mill?
Mm-hmm. Was the union already established?
No, it came in about, I'd say, 2 weeks or 2-3 weeks after I was in. Oh, yes, we had to sign up whether we agreed to have the union come in. My father was a, I forgot what they called it now. Anyways, he was working for the union. And I forget what they called it, it's stupid. If there was an argument or something, you know, he'd say, well, she's got seniority over this one, she should get priority on a job or whatever.
So. I think they called them agents.
It wasn't quite the word, but okay. it was more or less an agent, you know.
Yeah, or a representative,
maybe. Yeah. So he was one of that. I remember Mr. Jaybird coming to my house at 1 Knox Street, him and Mr. Cody, Mr. Doobie, excuse me, not Mr. Cody, and Mr. Doobie, and two other men, I forgot their names. But they were all dressed in three-piece suits and, you know, quite impressive.
Yeah. And they were union people?
They were union people. Oh, yes. Mr. Jaybird was the head of the CIO. CIO. Union.
So did the mill workers, the majority of them, think the union was a good thing?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they did. They did. Well, their wages went up. Mm. You know, they had to pay us like a minimum wage, and that was that. And different jobs, well, with different wages. Mm-hmm. So it was, at the time, quite an improvement on the in the mill. Yeah. In the mill.
Now, you said you were a weaver for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Did you like that job, or were there many other women doing that, or was
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Quite a few. Quite a few.
Because
yeah.
I've heard of men weavers, and I didn't know if that was a...
The men, most... well, yes, there were men weavers. My father was a weaver.
Mm-hmm.
And so was my uncle Ernest and Uncle Joe. They were weavers, too. We were weaving on rayon, and during the war we made parachutes, cloth for parachutes. And we got the Navy or the Army E for excellent, for doing an excellent job. But then the mill started to work three shifts, you know. They were first, second, and third shift. So I worked on all the three shifts. when I went to be a room girl, that was another promotion, I worked on the third shift, which was from 12 to 7. 11 to 7. Mm. So, and I worked that almost. Well, I worked at the Endoscopicon for almost 30 years. Because, see, I went in, I was 18,
mm-hmm.
and my husband died, I was 32, and we were still at the Androscoggin. So.
And did you move to the Hill Mill for a while?
Yes, I went, then when the Androscoggin started to close down, I was transferred. I was one of the lucky ones, I guess. I was transferred to the Bates Mill. He asked me to go work on the Bates Mill. What a difference. Boy, did I sneeze over there.
In the Bates Mill?
Yeah.
It was air?
It was cotton. Uh-huh. So there was a lot of dust. And over there, I worked on the Queen Elizabeth and the Martha Washington. And in no time at all, I was a room girl over there, too. So that's what I had been hired for, as a room girl, but I had to go through, learn the basics, you know, of how the machines were quite different. They run on the same principle, but where rayon was, they had like a chain going around for patterns, you know. Well, over there they call them cards. They start from the ceilings. They're just like your computer cards.
Mm-hmm.
They were all little holes in them, and they it was quite different. Quite a difference between the rayon and the cotton, and so I had to learn the basics. Then I became a room girl and worked on the Martha Washingtons and the Queen Elizabeth, and there my second husband, Romeo Rivard, was working there, and when I was weaving, he'd come over and give me a hand, and explain to me, so it was quite helpful. So my husband had left me with an apartment building on 51 Pierce, and the front door, I wanted a mail slot in the front door, so I asked Mr. Rivard if he could do that. So he came over one night, and we had coffee, and we started going out, and ended up getting married. And I had two sons with him. I lost a little girl too, Delia. But I had Mark and Christian.
So you had four grown children.
Oh, yes, okay. Yes. I'm a great-grandmother four times.
Wow. And how many grandchildren do you have?
Seven. Seven grandchildren.
Now, when you were at the Androscoggin Mill and you were using the rayon,
mm-hmm.
Well, did you also make coffin linings?
Coffin linings, and we made the coffin linings, and we made what they called a lino. It was a curtain, stuff like this,
mm-hmm.
to me. But it was more like a lace, you know. There was a solid stripe and a lacy stripe, mm-hmm. and but I would, my hands are small, if you see, and that was great for me because the heddles were so close to one another. You had to do it. So my small hands came in handy, and there was a Mrs. Dubay. She was a not fat, but a rather husky person, and she had big hands. She had so much trouble going through the huddle, and once in a while she'd said, "Can you come and give me a hand over there?" And it was fun. It was work, but you know, it seems it wasn't as how can I explain it? It wasn't bearing down on you like, you know, like today. If you're not precise and precise on the job, you've got to look on your shoulder most of the time to see that. It wasn't like that, you know.
Yeah.
The foreman or the super of the company would walk around and talk to you like he was your brother rather than, you know, you're not doing this right, you're not doing this right. You know, he'd say, if you do it this way, it'd be much easier for you and less complicated for us. And, you know, they'd be maybe better well-mannered or more courteous than today, you know. So, oh, some of them are still, I'm not knocking everyone now,
yeah.
Don't get me
yeah.
wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
But today some of them are almost brutal, you know. Mm-hmm. They have no, I don't know if they got to where they are the hard way or what made them like that, but.
Were there also organized activities for the mill workers?
We had a picnic once a year, mm-hmm. for all the mill workers provided, and there was a bowling team. We had a bowling team, and the men had different activities, and I guess some of the women were not interested in those, you know.
Did you bowl?
Yes, I did. I did. The first time, it was a loon fixer that asked me if I wouldn't go bowling a Saturday afternoon. It was on Middle Street. Oh my goodness, they're gone now. It was Candle Pin.
Uh-huh.
And they were amazed. The first time I bowled, I was making strikes one after the other. And I didn't know what I was doing. It was so funny. I'd have a spare and I'd say, well, what do I do now? But it was fun. I gave them a good laugh anyways, but I didn't, it wasn't for me, you know. I didn't stay with the bowling team. I went 4 or 5 times and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
Singing was my ambition, so.
Were you able to find things in the community to join for singing over the years?
The church choir.
Yeah.
Yes, the church choir. But,
in which church did you go to?
St. Peter's, mm-hmm. the Basilica today. Mm-hmm. I was in the Basilica choir till about a month ago. I got involved in the play, Lost in the New Home for Me. Mm-hmm. Then I'm with the group, singing group, Just Us. So we have, you know, it's a practice once a week. And I don't like to go out too much during the winter nights, especially when it's stormy. So I haven't been going to practice, but I've got to go back.
When it gets warmer.
Yeah, well, the choir director asked me to, if I wouldn't sing the French Mass at 4:30 on Saturday afternoon, at 4 o'clock, excuse me, on Saturday afternoon. And even though I've sung in public, like I had joined the Snowshoers, and at every installation, well, most clubs would ask that I sing the National Anthem and the Canadian Anthem. And I really enjoy that. And I've sung in front of audience before. It doesn't bother me at all, you know. But my sister says, well, why can't you do it? I don't feel worthy. There's something holding me back. I know the Mass by heart, you know. And I know all the parts by heart, the Alleluia, the Gloria, the you name it. But I don't know, something's holding me back. It isn't that I'm grateful, I'm very grateful to the Lord that I have a voice, but, you know, it's like our next program coming up for the elderly is, I'm going to be singing Cœur de Maman. It's a French song. You might have heard of it. You don't know. You speak French, or?
Just a little.
Oh, just a little.
Just a little.
And you have a French name.
Yes. By marriage, though.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, but I did study French. I just, you know, don't get to use it. Oh. With family and friends, because
yes,
no one else speaks it, so I lose it, yeah, over time.
Mm-hmm. My son, Mark, who's in Arizona, speaks perfect English, no accent, mm-hmm, not like me. And I'll speak to him in French and he'll answer in English. He understands every word I say in French. And in fact, last week he called me up and he said, I spoke to him in French and I started to repeat in English. He said, you don't have to repeat, Mom. I understood everything you, every word you said. So it makes it.
And is he in his 40s?
He's 42. 40, he'll be 44 in April. Please. Yeah, my daughter is 55, and it's 55. When we're done with the interview, I'll show them all the pictures in my rogues gallery over there.
And so when your kids were growing up, you were still speaking French in the
French.
Home?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And when you were a child growing up, was it just French in the home and you learned
definitely.
English at school?
It's English at school, that's it. Good old St. Peter's School, that's where I started to speak English. I went to Holy Cross School. We were living on River Road. Well, I was just a little girl then. And my father used to walk from, you know where Geiger Brother is on River Road? Well, we lived in the, they have which mobile homes now, but we used to live on a house right there on corner of River Road and Cottage Road. And he used to walk down to the Androscoggin to go to work. And my mother used to walk from there to the shoe shops in Auburn when she didn't get a ride.
So your mom worked in the shoe shop?
My mom worked in the shoe shop.
Which?
And she was a fancy stitcher. And my father sometimes would bring scrap of cloth from the mill, I guess everybody did, and she'd make us clothes with it, nightgowns or something like that, you know. So that's what I told Mr. Silver yesterday, that, you know, when they'd measure so many yards, and if maybe there was a quarter of a yard left, rather than just wrap it up, they'd cut it off and throw it, or when we started a new pattern, you know, we'd have to run it about a couple of yards and make sure that everything was perfect. So we call that the scrap or whatever. We cut it off and throw it away. So if you were around, you could pick it up out of the trash barrel.
I was at the museum, LA, yesterday, looking at all the different patterns. Beautiful.
Oh,
yeah. Variety.
I was telling Mr. Silva yesterday that I do have some remnants, but it's to locate them. I packed everything. I was living upstairs, and I moved downstairs, so I had to change all boxes and everything else, and they're in a box somewhere. The background, we had what we call a double wall, and the upper one was multicolor, and the bottom one was black. So it was a black material with like a bright yellow, red, green, and it kept repeating, you know, red, green. And I have a swatch of that here, a little piece of it. And my father had bought some, my mother made cushions, the cushion cover for cushions, and it was beautiful, beautiful. So I want to dig that up and bring them to the center, to the base.
Are there certain people, presidents of the mill, that stand out in your mind that you recall, could describe?
There was Mr. I can see him in my mind, but there was Mr. Gravel that worked at the Bates. He was my boss at the mill. He was a very nice person, always gentle, never, you know, just smooth going, never a word higher than the other, as you might say. And at the end of Skagen, I remember almost every, Bob Basinger was my boss, then Tony Martell was the superior, and Dean Quinton was the big honcho. So, and the second in charge was Joe Bussière. He didn't, I don't know what happened to him, he left. And Tony Martell was one of them. Yeah, I just said Tony Martell. And of course, Gerard Ouellette, who was my brother-in-law, and Gutiérrez lives down the corner.
Some of the supervisors that you
The supervisors in the mill, mm-hmm. Yes.
And
I had a cousin, too, that worked in the carding room, but I never... Do you know, as long as I've worked in the mill, I never was upset to the carding room and the other room. Mm. I went to the finishing room, when I worked at the Bates, I worked on the cutting room, in the cutting room, where you take the bedspread, pull it up, throw it on a big table, and there was two girls that would pull the side till it was at the measurement, then we cut it. And those two girls would come back, fold it, and put it on a rack and take it the stitches on the other side of the room. And my daughter's mother-in-law used to work there, put the fringe around Mrs. Fournier. And she worked there. At the time, we never knew that we'd be both be the mother-in-law, you know.
Yeah.
But she was working there. And
do you recall any strikes that occurred during
at the Bates?
Mm-hmm.
I recall the, but I think it's vague. Seems to me it only lasted like 2 or 3 weeks at the most.
Yeah.
But there, because there were still people going in, and I don't think I ever did strike. We went back in.
Yeah.
I was one of the. What they call us, a scrab or something
Scabs.
Like that.
Yeah.
Scab.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it wasn't something profound, you know. It was something stupid that they were striking about. That's why I think that they lost, because it wasn't something major, I should have said.
Yeah.
It was more of a dispute than a strike.
Okay. Do you know what decade that was in?
Oh my God, that must have been in the 55, that must have been in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
60s.
Yeah. So there weren't a lot of strikes over the years that you recall?
No, that was about the only time that I recall that people had walked out. The day they had said that there was going to be a strike, I think the mill emptied. You know, everybody walked out. And I was wondering. I've never been in those days. I've changed a little bit. In those days, I wouldn't get in everybody's business or like a go-getter, you know. Mm-hmm. See, but today I want to know what's going on. What's this? What's that? What's this? What's that? And I walked out with the rest of us, with the rest of them, and I was wondering why, what was going on. Mm-hmm. And my loom fixer, the loom fixer at the time, Emil Roy, said, you know, this is stupid, and this, we shouldn't do this, and this and that. So when my husband walked back in, with my boyfriend at the time, when he walked back in, I walked back in too. Mm-hmm. So. And there was a Mr. Poussard at the Andrews Gargan. He was a foreman too. And his sister-in-law was room girl with me. See, we were partners, room girl, because one has to work in the back. If you know what a warp is and how the cloth, the back is a big, big roll of threads, you know, huge, right. Huge. And it goes through my goodness, I should have looked up my before the interview.
Okay.
It goes through to it's a little metal things that used to fall.
Mm-hmm.
And when a tread broke, it would fall and stop the loom.
Okay.
So what a room girl did, when there was over 10 threads that were broken together, well, one would stand in back and retread those and hand them to the girl in front so she could put them through the heddles and then the reed and then tie them up so she could start the loom again for the material. And that's also how come you would get some scrap material. Because sometimes the loom would keep going, there was just one thread broken, the loom would keep going and that thread would get tangled with the other and then you'd have a breakout. so the cloth that didn't have a pass inspection, you know, would... So after we had fixed everything, sometimes she'd put okay on it, you know, from wherever it would start to be okay. And when the cut boy would come and remove the cut, he'd have to throw what wasn't good, have thrown in the trash. And I remember one time, they had made a sample. They had about, it was black and white, a black and white stripe with a little ridge between each stripe. And we used to go in early and shampoo our hair and put it up in pin curls. I don't know how many girls did that. I was one of them. So, Mr. Quinton and Mr. Martell and Bob Basinger came up to me and said, there was a sample on this loom. Did you happen to see it? I said, no, I didn't see it. And all the time I had cut the piece off and made a turban with it. I was wearing it on my head and they never saw it. Ooh, wow. Did I shake? Did I have the shakes? But then Tony Martell looked at me and he just smiled as though he was going to say, I know where it is. But he never said a word. Never said a word. So they had to weave another sample. Another time, a loom fixer, well, a room girl, you didn't get called on until there was a break or we had to change a wall, you know, when the walls run out. The tying machine would tie them, then we'd have to pull them through, and whatever thread broke when we pulled them through, we had to fix those. And so when we had nothing to do, there was what they call, it was no bigger than here about, we called the smoke room. Well, some of us would bring crocheting, some of us, and I would knit. I was knitting my father a sweater, I remember that. So, Nap Ranville, a loom fixer, took, in the shuttle there was squirrel hair, a squirrel fur, so that it would run smooth, it wouldn't, the fur didn't mat. And he had taken a piece, and every once in a while you'd see a mouse, you know, in the mill, and most of us would scream when we'd see a mouse. Well, he had taken a piece of squirrel fur and put in the sleeve of the sweater I was making, because he saw me try the sleeve on for the lint every once in a while. And he had called the other loom fixers, they're all in the smoke room when they saw me leave. I saw him go like this, but everybody, all the guys were sitting there, and I was sitting in front of them, and I put my hand through the sleeves, and I feel that fur. I screamed my head off, threw my knitting right across the room. I thought it was a mouse, and well, the guys were laughing their heads off, of course. Huh? Okay, payback. So he had left his toolbox next to a loom with the strap. You know, they used to have a strap on their little toolbox and carry them, just drag them from one place to the other when they fixed the looms. I take a big nail, spike, nail this box to the floor. Then I went down the other end of my looms and put up the stick. When you put up a red stick, meant that the loom was broken. If the stick was yellow, means it was a job for the room girl, even though they write them down. Well, he grabs his strap and gives it a yank, and the strap stays in his hands. I was bent in two laughing. He says, you little, I'll get even, but he never did. And it was fun like that, yeah. You know, that we had. Like I said, it was more like a big family than today it seems people aren't that friendly. Though they are friendly, but I mean, It's not the same thing.
Great. Thank you very much.
No. We're over.